Let's go on a trip.
Let's go on a trip.
Yeah, baby.
It's not too bad. What was the question again?
Okay, let's go. I'm Angela Caterns.
I'm Ian Rogerson.
And welcome to Suddenly Senior. This is a podcast series for those of us who've reached a certain age in life.
That's right. You can join if you're not our age, but it'll be a lot more fun if you are.
So strap yourselves in, check your blood pressure, light your spliff.
Pour yourself a small bevy and let's go.
Clive Hamilton is one of Australia's most well-known public intellectuals. He's a professor of public ethics and is the founder of the progressive think tank, the Australia Institute. A passionate advocate of evidence-based research, he's become notable in recent years for shining a spotlight on China's creeping influence on global politics and business. But he also has many thoughts on ageing and ageism. Hello and welcome, Senior Clive Hamilton.
G'day, Angela. G'day, Ian.
Clive, you're 69, I think, and still in full-time work. Do you consider yourself lucky to be able to still be working?
Extremely lucky. I mean, I'm one of those people whose, you know, jobs is something I love to do, and so you kind of hang on to it. And the idea of, you know, retiring from it is kind of you treat with horror. So, yeah, I'm lucky, and I hope I can keep going and tell you the truth. Even when they stop paying me, I'll keep doing the same thing.
That's the attitude. I reckon you probably would have been like this since school. Were you the kid with his hand up all the time?
Yeah, not always in a way that was appreciated, I have to say. I remember once when I was in sixth form, my second sixth form, because I failed the first time, had to go back and just scraped into university. But I put up a picture, a very gruesome picture in the senior student common room. And, you know, it is gruesome. It was actually, this is Vietnam War, right? And there was a South Vietnamese soldier, so one of our allies, standing there holding two severed heads. And I was so shocked. I tore it out of a magazine. It was very traumatizing. I stuck it up in the senior common room and said, this is our war in Vietnam. And within a few minutes, the headmaster came storming down the quad into the senior common room and ripped it off the wall and took off. And I was following after him saying, hey, I've got a right to free speech. You can't do that. Anyway, he could. So, yeah, that's what I was like.
Clive, I mentioned, you know, that you were the founder of the progressive think tank, the Australia Institute. So how do you actually define progressive? And do you think you've become more progressive as you've grown older?
Oh, good question. I used to get this a lot. I always said the Australia Institute was a progressive think tank to try to avoid the label of left wing. We were left wing, but it was better not to be so described because people pigeonhole you. Although we were out there at times at the Australia Institute, really challenging the authorities, and copped a lot of blowback as a result.
Mm-hmm. And have you become more progressive as you've grown older?
No, I wouldn't say so. I mean, a lot of people from the left become a bit more conservative as they age. It's fairly standard kind of observation. I'm still just as kind of passionate and driven. I guess my worldview has matured. I'm less idealistic. I'm much more concerned about how we can hang on to what we've got, that is the natural world, for example, or the freedoms that I've grown up with and enjoyed for decades, which now are jeopardized. So there is a question whether emotionally I've kind of mellowed, if I haven't politically, and maybe I'm a bit less reactive to things, but it's not so much mellowing, it's more disheartened with the world. You know, I've kind of defeated, if you like.
Gee, I've got to say that defeated point's a very interesting one because we're all boomers, at least here amongst the three of us. And I find the defeated angle is really one that I look at ourselves, we were at least trying to fix things, but there didn't seem to be as many things to fix. But now you end up looking everywhere you turn, there's something to fix. And I look at the next generation and the generation before that as well and go, oh, my God, they've got it all in front of them. And I wonder how they feel. They feel a little bit sort of cut off from the whole thing. It can make you a little depressed. Where's the chink of light there?
Well, I mean, I suppose we boomers ought to remember the victories. You know, we completely transformed society. If you think back in the 60s, before the social revolutions of the late 60s, 70s, 80s, think about, the treatment of women and gay people and people of colour. I mean, it was appalling back then, the stuff that happened. Of course, it's not, the revolutions aren't completed, but the transformation has been incredible. So we ought to kind of celebrate and remember that. But it is galling, I have to say, when younger people don't recognise that and assume that they're the progressive ones and we're conservatives and if only we understood. And I think, well, really, you're standing on our shoulders. Perhaps we should give you a little bit of the history of that. But anyway, that's the way of the world, I suppose.
That's when they tune out, Clive. Mm-hmm.
But then I wonder if we should feel guilty at all for leaving the planet in the dreadful state that it's in. We did have the opportunity to, halt the destruction.
I take your point, Angela, but I think the response is, well, who is this we?
Mm.
Because some of us, a large proportion of us, tried really hard to protect the planet and pass on a livable, beautiful, natural environment for our children and grandchildren. But in a way, if you think about the social movements, gay rights, Indigenous rights, women's rights, actually, it was the environment movement that represented the most dangerous challenge to the system, if you like. And it's the one that's, in a sense, failed most because the system has caused this massive destruction and we've been unable to stop it.
At least we're not nuclear armed. Remember, there were the no nukes movements and demonstrations. At least I think we won that one.
Well, indeed, yeah. But I look at the state of Australia's natural environment, as we've heard in the last few days. It's appalling, and our greenhouse gas emissions and our record is shocking. So nothing matters unless we can really leave a decent environment for future generations.
I'm interested, Clive, about the way you think. You're described in your Wikipedia page as a public intellectual, and I always thought you people always did think privately at home. But it's if you've got that brain and you're actually seeing things happen in front of you, do you spend a long time thinking to come to a conclusion, or is it something you instantly work out?
Oh no, it takes a long time. I mean, look. It's sometimes if I decide to write a book, for example, you have to do a lot of research, a lot of reading, thinking about how to organise the argument and so on. But it's a kind of process that you go through, and I'm pretty good at it now. Sometimes, though, you confront a problem where you have to kind of radically change your understanding of the world, and that's much more difficult and takes more time and may not happen. So, yeah, there's a lot of time thinking and reading and maybe talking to other people, though I don't do much of that. I'm a real introvert. I just spend the vast majority of my time sitting quietly in my office hoping no one will knock on the door.
Is that true?
It is. I'm terrible, actually. The Germans have this great word, as they have great words for many things, called Plauschplage. And it means the pain of having to engage in everyday banter with one's work colleagues. You just want to go and get a cup of tea and go back into your office and keep working. But someone
you're not
insists,
a fan of the water cooler chat.
No, I'm not. Or Melbourne Cup days or Christmas parties. It's the burden of the introvert, I guess.
So, Clive, I know the Institute did some research on the benefits of an ageing population. Can you tell us what are the benefits and has Australia capitalised on those benefits enough?
Well, this was in the context of the kind of ageing crisis, which, I was sitting there thinking this is manufactured. You remember the intergenerational report?
Mm.
And there was a kind of panic on. And older people were presented and characterized. The media took this up and amplified it as a burden on the workforce, a burden on society, a burden on the budget. There was so much blame being dumped on older people. And I thought, you know, this can't be right. And so I commissioned a report that looked at the data, and, you know, the big one was healthcare, for example. And actually, the big costs of healthcare occur in the last year of life. You know, it doesn't matter how old you are. In fact, there's evidence that, you know, the medical system will spend more money on a 55-year-old than they will on an 85-year-old if they've got exactly the same condition. Kind of makes sense. So we thought, well, but what about the benefits no one talks about? I mean, for example, an obvious one, older people engage in a huge amount of care. I mean, the young old look after the old old. And as my daughter, Myra, who's a social policy researcher, has shown in her work, grandparents provide more care for little kids than the childcare sector itself. Mm. So the whole place would collapse without grandparents carrying out this unpaid labour. The other thing that struck me in the data is that as Australian society ages, we will become a more law-abiding society. I mean, truth is that 60-year-olds don't murder people very much.
I haven't got the energy for it.
Something like that. So there's going to be a lot of cost savings and policing and courts and prisons and stuff. You know, what I really look forward to is fewer hoons on the road.
Oh, yeah. And their loud bikes.
Have you ever experienced ageism personally, Clive?
No, I don't think so. And there's this funny thing that happens that I'm sure we've all experienced when you're kind of getting older. One of the kind of transition points happens fairly early, and that is when you realise when your children are 30-plus and they start have children, there's a kind of power shift, and you suddenly realise, hey, they're the adults now. They're the ones in the prime of life, and I'm the one on the decline. And so I think it was kind of from about that point that my son started referring to me as old man. How's it going, old man? Okay, I can wear that.
That is a bit of a revelation, isn't it, though, that when you suddenly realise that because of your age, you are on the outer, where once you were in the middle.
Yeah, I absolutely indeed. And you realise it's really – when you realise, not that you're now irrelevant, because, you know, it happened to me when I was, I don't know, 45, 50, I suppose, kind of prime of life in a way, but it does reinforce the fact there's a generation coming up behind and it won't be too long before you go out. And I noticed there was an interesting segment on ABC Radio the other day. I was kind of phone in or text in about grumpy old men. Mm-hmm. And I started to think about this term, grumpy old men. And grumpy is a kind of euphemism, isn't it? You know, for, you know, angry, cantankerous, and so on. But it also is kind of disempowering. You know, grumpy is kind of, oh, yeah, he's just grumpy. And it's kind of infantilizing. You know, the way in which mature women used to be described and still are sometimes as girls, or the way in which Scott Morrison in the big furore of Brittany Higgins referred to as Brittany. Yeah. You know, it was kind of making her a little girl. And there's a lot of language around that which starts to be imposed on older people that kind of reflects your increasing disempowerment. Of course, you really know you're old when instead of falling over, you've had a fall.
That's right.
That's right. That is the mark.
Yes.
That is the mark. But can grumpiness be mistaken for, you know, kind of impatience with stupidity or, you know, impatience with bad decision-making rather than just, you know, some kind of bad-tempered old bloke?
I guess it can be. And, you know, it's often observed that some grumpy old blokes are grumpy because, you know, they can be and they don't really care what people think. But, you know, in that case, I've been grumpy most of my life. but and also there's kind of intolerance in the sense of losing patience with the world. both the world around you and the larger world. I mean, I'm sure like many people my age, we still shout just as loudly at the television news most nights.
Yeah, and that's already up so loud anyway, it started the neighbours to get worried. Clive, I understand that. Well, you're no longer the front and centre of the production that is your life when you get to our age. You realise that everybody else is having their turn. But there's some real benefits in that as well, isn't there? You don't have the pressure on you used to have. You're able to spend more time looking at a few other things, and you've also come up with some shortcuts.
Yeah, definitely. When you're no longer in the rat race, that you're no longer aspiring to bigger and better, but cruising and living off your talents and experience, that's terrific. You know, when you're having your greatest successful time of life, it's always stressful and difficult, and you're full of self-doubts and you beat up on yourself for your mistakes. So it's terrific to transition beyond that, particularly if you've got the opportunity, as the three of us have, to keep on doing what we like doing.
Mm. And writing's exactly. One of yours. I mean, we've only got a 20-minute show, otherwise we'd go through all the books you've written. But I think you've got a new one coming out very shortly called Provocateur, which it sounds like the theme of your life.
Well, that was the title chosen for the memoir that I've written. That's been a very fascinating experience to reflect back. And, you know, I was sitting there at the end writing the kind of last couple of pages in my office, and someone said, oh, you should be proud of what you've achieved, Clive. Satisfied. And I was thinking about it. And then suddenly this man came around the office building with a leaf blower. It was a roaring thing. He had industrial earmuffs on, and it drove me nuts. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this never goes away.
Well, the leaf blower or your reaction to
it? Oh, the leaf blower. I hate leaf blowers, don't you? I mean,
oh, everybody hates them.
I know. I hear one. I think, what's wrong with a broom?
Exactly.
Anyway. But so, Clive, what about, you have left quite a legacy, haven't you, in the Australia Institute. Is that something you think about, the importance of leaving a legacy? Do you feel happy about that? Do you think we should all think about what legacy we're going to leave behind?
It's a funny thing because, before I wrote a memoir, I read two or three books about writing a memoir because I hadn't written one. It's a different style of writing. There are all kinds of traps that you've got to try and avoid. And one of the motivations for writing a memoir is legacy recognition or legacy building, I suppose. And I found that the Australia Institute, I'm glad I did. I think it was a good thing to do, definitely. And it's still there and going strongly and recognised and so on and so forth. But I just felt it was the thing I had to do.
Mm.
And so I did it, and I built it and ran it for 14 years, and I left and went on and did other things. I'm really glad it's there and that I did it. But I can't say I feel this really strong sense of pride. It was just, it was good. I don't want to disavow it in the least or be, false modesty, but it was just kind of, that's how my life unfolded.
That's very laconic. That's what I was called to do, and that's what I went and did. And I guess that's the thoughts also of somebody who's at our stage in life, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed. And I think those of us who feel that we were called and followed through on our passions are very privileged. I should say that I spent the first 20 years of my adult life desperately wondering what on earth I was supposed to do and being really miserable and moved to two or three jobs. And it was only when I was 40 that I resigned from my job and I thought, I'm going to set up a progressive think tank, because we didn't have any then.
Mm.
We had plenty of right-wing think tanks that were very influential. So this was in the early 90s. And it was only then when I did it that I finally felt that I'd found the thing I was meant to do, but it took a really long time to get there.
Yeah. But you did. Fantastic. And you did it well.
So, Clive, what about looking forward now? Do you have hopes and dreams for the future of things you'd still like to achieve?
Oh, definitely. I've got a couple of books on the go. I'll keep researching and writing as long as someone's willing to publish it and as long as my brain hasn't collapsed, you know. I mean, that's...
Is that a fear of yours, by the way?
Oh, absolutely, you know, because if I started, you know, getting dementia, that'd be the end. I mean, I wouldn't know what else to do. I mean, I don't really have any hobbies other than trying to stay fit and some bird watching. You know, like many men of my age, I don't have very many friends.
Mm. Well, you don't answer the door to them, do you?
That's important.
Well, I mean, there's a truth to that because having a, you know, I kind of envy people who have a lot of friends, but it takes a lot of time.
It does.
Yeah.
You know, you have to really invest in it. Mm. And the truth is I'd rather be, you know, reading and writing. You know, so for many years I've thought, oh, I'm antisocial, I should make more friends. No. But now I'm reframing it, thinking, well, no, I'm just self-sufficient.
That's who you are, Clive. We should actually hook up with you sometime in Canberra, Clive, purely to take you out for a drink. I think you probably need it.
I'd love that.
That'd be great. And it's been such a pleasure having a chat with you as well, Clive. What fun. It's been great.
We thank you for your time, Clive Hamilton. A delight.
I've enjoyed it. Thanks, Anne. Thanks, Angela. Good on you.
Oh, I'm very glad that we had Clive Hamilton on Suddenly Senior, aren't you, Ian?
I think he's the biggest brain we've ever had on. And
What? How do you measure the biggest brain?
Oh, just by the pure output. That man's put out so many books. It's frightening. I could set up a library of his books. He's just prolific.
By their output. I don't think you should judge the actual size of their brain.
Oh,
I feel we need to describe him in another fashion.
Well, okay, have a shot at it. What do you reckon?
Okay. You know, fascinating, not really.
Okay, so we're going to stick with big brain then.
But not grumpy.
No, certainly. Ungrumpy. No, a lovely, lovely, gentle, lovely man. Thank you for listening to Suddenly Senior. Don't forget, of course, you can find us online anywhere you like at Facebook or any of the other books or Grams or
Spotify,
whatever it may be.
Yeah.
Get your kids to find out.
You just Google it and it comes, boom.
That's right. Yeah, no, that's great. When people say, where do you get Suddenly Senior from? I say, Google it. Google it.
Exactly.
We'll talk
okay.
next time.
Catch time.
See you, Ange.
Bye. 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 Bye.
No, you gone yet?
Bye.
Bye. Please like and also subscribe.
Thank you for listening. I'm Angela Caterns.
I'm Ian Rogerson.
Leave a comment, as long as it's nice. If it's not,
that's right.
Fuck off.
Yes. See you next time, Ange.
Bye. And I want wine with my meds.